that made it look like a carnival ride had been found at the roadside by one of the hundreds of rescue workers still clearing up the mess at Felicitas. She knew what Granger was driving. She had found out by asking the commune members what cars they had and checking which was missing. He was using a pickup truck, and she had put out an all-points bulletin on it. In theory, every cop in California should be looking for it, although most of them would be too busy coping with the emergency. She was tantalized unbearably by the thought that she might have caught Granger at the commune if she had fought harder and persuaded Cleaver to raid the place last night instead of this morning. But she had just been too tired. She felt better today. The raid had pumped adrenaline into her system and given her energy. But she was bruised physically and mentally, running on empty. A small TV set on the kitchen counter was on with the sound muted. The news came on, and Judy asked Mrs. Quirkus to turn up the volume. There was an interview with John Truth, who had spoken on the phone to Granger. He played an extract from his tape of the conversation. 7 o'clock, Granger said on the tape. It will hit at 7 tonight. Judy shivered. He meant it. There was no regret or remorse in his voice, no sign that he hesitated to risk the lives of so many people. He sounded rational, but there was a flaw in his humanity. He did not really care about the suffering of others. It was the characteristic of psychopaths. She wondered what Simon Sparrow would make of the voice, but it was too late now for psycholinguistics. She went to the kitchen door and called, "Michael, we have to go." She would have liked to leave Michael here with Dusty, where they would both be safe, but she needed him at the command post. His expertise might be crucial. He came in with Dusty. "I'm about ready," he said. The phone rang, and Mrs. Quirkus picked it up. After a moment, she held out the receiver to Dusty. "Someone for you," she said. Dusty took the phone and said tentatively, "Hello?" Then his face brightened. "Hi, Mom." Judy froze. It was Melanie. Dusty said, "I woke up this morning and you were gone. Then Daddy came to get me." Melanie was with Priest and the seismic vibrator, almost certainly. Judy grabbed her mobile and dialed the command post. She got Roger and said quietly, "Trace a call. Melanie Quirkus is calling a number in Stockton." She read the number off the instrument Dusty was using. "Call started a minute ago, still in progress." "I'm on it," Roger said. Judy broke the connection. Dusty was listening, nodding and shaking his head occasionally, forgetting that his mother could not see his movements. Then he abruptly offered the phone to his father. "She wants you." Judy whispered to Michael, "For God's sake, find out where she is." He took the phone from Dusty and held it against his chest, muffling it. "Pick up the bedroom extension." "Where?" Mrs. Quirkus said, "Just across the hall, dear." Judy darted into the bedroom, threw herself across the flowered bedspread, and grabbed the phone from the bedside table, covering the mouthpiece with her hand. She heard Michael say, "Melanie, where the hell are you?" "Never mind," Melanie replied. "I saw you and Dusty on TV. Is he okay?" "So she's been watching TV wherever she is." "Dusty's fine," Michael said. "We just got here." "I was hoping you'd be there." Her voice was low, and Michael said, "Can you speak up?" "No, I can't. So just listen harder, okay?" "She doesn't want Granger to hear her." "That's good. It may be a sign that they're beginning to disagree." "Okay, okay," Michael said. "You're going to stay there with Dusty, right?" "No," Michael said. "I'm going into the city."
"What? For God's sake, Michael, it's dangerous."
"Is that where the earthquake will be, in San Francisco?"
"I can't tell you."
"Will it be on the peninsula?"
"Yes, on the peninsula, so keep Dusty away."
Judy's cell phone beeped. Keeping the mouthpiece of the bedroom phone tightly covered, she put the cell phone to her other ear and said,
"Yeah."
It was Raja.
"She's calling on her mobile. It's in downtown San Francisco. They can't do better than that for a digital phone. Get some people out in the streets looking for that pickup."
"You got it."
Judy broke the connection. Michael was saying, "If you're so worried, why don't you just tell me where the seismic vibrator is?"
"I can't do that," Melanie hissed. "You're out of your mind."
"Come on, I'm out of my mind? You're the one who's causing earthquakes."
"I can't talk anymore."
There was a click. Judy replaced the handset on the bedside phone and rolled over onto her back, her mind racing. Melanie had given away a great deal of information. She was somewhere in downtown San Francisco, and although that did not make her easy to find, it was a smaller haystack than the whole of California. She had said the earthquake would be triggered somewhere on the San Francisco Peninsula, the broad neck of land between the Pacific Ocean and the San Francisco Bay. The seismic vibrator had to be somewhere in that area. But most intriguing, to Judy, had been the hint of some division between Melanie and Granger. She had obviously been making the call without telling him, and she had seemed to be afraid he might overhear. That was hopeful. There might be a way Judy could take advantage of a split. She closed her eyes, concentrating. Melanie was worried about Dusty. That was her weakness. How could it be used against her? She heard footsteps and opened her eyes. Michael came into the room. He gave her a strange look.
"What?" she said.
"This may seem inappropriate, but you look great lying on a bed." She remembered she was in his parents' house. She stood up. He wrapped his arms around her. It felt good.
"How's your face?" he said.
She looked up at him.
"If you're very gentle..."
He kissed her lips softly.
"If he wants to kiss me when I look this bad, he must really like me."
She said. "When this is all over..."
"Yes."
She closed her eyes for a moment. Then she started thinking about Melanie again.
"Michael..."
"Still here." She detached herself from his embrace. "Melanie is worried that Dusty might be in the earthquake zone."
"He's going to be here."
"But you didn't confirm that. She asked you, but you said if she was worried, she should tell you where the seismic vibrator is, and you never answered her question properly."
"Still the implication. I mean, why would I take him into danger?"
"I'm just saying she may have a nagging doubt. And wherever she is, there's a TV." "She leaves the news on all day sometimes. It relaxes her."
Judy felt a stab of jealousy.
"He knows her so well." "What if we had a reporter interview you at the Emergency Operations Center in San Francisco about what you're doing to help the Bureau, and Dusty was, like, just in the background somewhere?"
"Then she'd know he was in San Francisco."
"And what would she do?"
"Call me and scream at me, I guess."
"And if she couldn't reach you?"
"She'd be real scared."
"But would she stop Granger from operating the seismic vibrator?"
"Maybe, if she could."
"Is it worth a try?"
"Is there another choice?"
Priest had a do-or-die feeling. Maybe the governor and the president would not give in to him, even after Felicitas. But tonight there would be a third earthquake. Then he would call John Truth and say, "I'll do it again. Next time it could be Los Angeles, or San Bernardino, or San Jose. I can do this as often as I like. I'm going to keep on until you give in. The choice is yours." Downtown San Francisco was a ghost town. Few people wanted to shop or sightsee, though plenty were going to church. The restaurant was half empty. Priest ordered eggs and drank three Bloody Marys. Melanie was subdued, worrying about Dusty. Priest thought the kid would be fine. He was with his father.
"Did I ever tell you why I'm called Granger?" he said to Melanie.
"It's not your parents' name?"
"My mother called herself Veronica Nightingale. She told me my father's name was Stuart Granger. He had gone on a long trip, she said, but one day he would come back in a big limousine loaded with presents. Perfume and chocolates for her, and a bicycle for me. On rainy days when I couldn't play in the streets, I used to sit at the window watching for him, hour after hour.
For a moment, Melanie seemed to forget her own problems.
"Poor kid," she said.
I was about 12 when I realized that Stuart Granger was a big movie star. He played Alan Quatermain in King Solomon's Mines just about the time I was born. I guess he was my mother's fantasy. Broke my heart, I can tell you. All those hours looking out the damn window.
Priest smiled, but the memory hurt.
Who knows? Melanie said. Maybe he was your father. Movie stars go to hookers.
I guess I should ask him.
He's dead.
Is he? I didn't know that.
Yeah, I read it in People magazine a few years ago.
Priest felt a pang of loss. Stuart Granger was the nearest thing to a father he had ever had.
Well, now I'll never know.
He shrugged and called for the bill.
When they left the restaurant, Priest did not want to return to the warehouse. He could easily sit doing nothing when he was at the commune, but in a dingy room in an industrial wasteland, he would get cabin fever. 25 years of living in Silver River Valley had spoiled him for the city. So he and Melanie walked around Fisherman's Wharf, making like tourists, enjoying the salty breeze off the bay. They had altered their appearance as a precaution. She had put up her distinctive long red hair and concealed it under a hat, and she wore sunglasses. Priest had greased his dark hair and plastered it to his head, and he had 3 days' growth of dark stubble on his cheeks, giving him a Latin lover air that was quite different from his usual aging hippie look. No one gave them a second glance. Priest listened in to the conversations of the few people walking around. Everyone had an excuse for not leaving town.
I'm not worried. Our building is earthquake-proof.
So's mine, but at 7 o'clock I'm going to be in the middle of the park.
I'm a fatalist. Either this earthquake has my name on it or it doesn't.
Exactly. You could drive to Vegas and get killed in a car wreck.
I've had my house retrofitted.
No one can cause earthquakes. It was a coincidence.
They got back to the car a few minutes after 4. Priest did not see the cop until it was almost too late.
The Bloody Marys had made him strangely calm, and he felt almost invulnerable, so he was not looking out for the police. He was only 8 or 10 feet from the pickup truck when he noticed a uniformed San Francisco cop staring at the license plate and speaking into a walkie-talkie.
Priest stopped dead and grabbed Melanie's arm. A moment later he realized that the smart thing to do was walk right by, but by then it was too late.
The cop glanced up from the license plate and caught Priest's eye.
Priest looked at Melanie. She had not seen the cop. He almost said, "Don't look at the car," but just in time he realized that would be sure to make her look. Instead, he said the next thing that came into his head.
"Look at my hand."
He turned his palm up.
She stared at it, then looked at him again.
"What am I supposed to see?"
"Keep looking at my hand while I explain."
She did as he said.
"We're going to walk right past the car. There's a cop taking the number. He's noticed us. I can see him out of the corner of my eye."
She looked up from his hand to his face. Then, to his astonishment, she slapped him.
It hurt.
He gasped.
Melanie cried, "And now you can just go back to your dumb blonde."
"What?" he said angrily.
She walked on. He watched her in astonishment. She strode past the pickup truck.
The cop looked at Priest with a faint grin.
Priest walked after Melanie, saying, "Now, just wait a minute."
The cop returned his attention to the license plate.
Priest caught up with Melanie, and they turned a corner.
"Very cute," he said.
"But you didn't have to hit me so hard."
A powerful portable spotlight shone on Michael, and a miniature microphone was clipped to the front of his dark green polo shirt. A small television camera on a tripod was aimed at him. Behind him, the young seismologists he had brought in worked at their screens. In front of him sat Alex Day, a 20-something television reporter with a fashionably short haircut. He was wearing a camouflage jacket, which Judy thought was overly dramatic.
Dusty stood beside Judy, holding her hand trustingly, watching his daddy being interviewed. Michael was saying, "Yes, we can identify locations where an earthquake could most easily be triggered, but unfortunately we can't tell which one the terrorists have chosen until they start up their seismic vibrator." "And what's your advice to citizens?" Alex Day asked. "How can they protect themselves if there is an earthquake?" "The motto is, duck, cover, and hold, and that's the best counsel," he replied. "Duck under a table or desk, cover your face to protect yourself from flying glass, and hold your position until the shaking stops." Judy whispered to Dusty, "Okay, go to Daddy." Dusty walked into the shot. Michael lifted the boy onto his knee. On cue, Alex Day said, "Anything special we can do to protect youngsters?" "Well, you could practice the duck cover and hold drill with them right now so they'll know what to do if they feel a tremor. Make sure they're wearing sturdy shoes, not thongs or sandals, because there will be a lot of broken glass around. And keep them close so you don't have to go searching for them afterward. Anything people should avoid? Don't run out of the house. Most injuries in earthquakes are caused by falling bricks and other debris from damaged buildings. Professor Korkus, thank you for being with us today." Alex Day smiled at Michael and Dusty for a long, frozen moment. Then the cameraman said, "Great." Everyone relaxed. The crew started rapidly packing up their equipment. Dusty said, "When can I go to Grandma's in the helicopter?" "Right now," Michael told him. Judy said, "How soon will that be on the air, Alex?" "It hardly needs editing, so it'll go right out. Within half an hour, I'd say." Judy looked at the clock. It was 5:15. Priest and Melanie walked for half an hour without seeing a taxi. Then Melanie called a cab service on her mobile phone. They waited, but no car came. Priest felt as if he was going mad. After all he had done, his great scheme was in jeopardy because he could not find a goddamn taxi. But at last a dusty Chevrolet pulled up at Pier 39. The driver had an unreadable Central European name, and he seemed stoned. He understood no English except left and right, and he was probably the only person in San Francisco who had not heard about the earthquake. They got back to the warehouse at 6:20. At the Emergency Operations Center, Judy slumped in her chair, staring at the phone. It was 6:25. In 35 minutes, Granger would start up his seismic vibrator. If it worked as well as it had the last two times, there would be an earthquake. But this one would be the worst. Assuming Melanie had told the truth and the vibrator was somewhere in the San Francisco Peninsula, the quake would almost certainly hit the city. Around 2 million people had fled the metropolitan area since Friday night, when Granger had announced on the John Truth Show that the next earthquake would hit San Francisco. But that left more than 1 million men, women, and children who were unable or unwilling to leave their homes. The poor, the old, and the sick, plus all the cops, firefighters, nurses, and city employees waiting to begin rescue work. And that included Bo. On the TV screen, Alex Day was speaking from a temporary studio set up at the mayor's emergency command center on Turk Street, a few blocks away. The mayor was wearing a hard hat and a purple vest and telling citizens to duck, cover, and hold. The interview with Michael ran every few minutes on all channels. The television editors had been told its real purpose. But it seemed Melanie was not watching. Priest's pickup had been found parked at Fisherman's Wharf at 4 o'clock. It was under surveillance, but he had not returned to it. Right now, every garage and parking lot in the neighborhood was being searched for a seismic vibrator. The ballroom of the officers' club was full of people. There were at least 40 suits around the headshed. Michael and his helpers were clustered around their computers, waiting for the inappropriately cheerful musical warning sound that would be the first sign of the seismic tremor they all feared. Judy's team was still working the phones, following up sightings of people who looked like Granger or Melanie, but there was an increasingly desperate tone to their voices. Using Dusty in the TV interview with Michael had been their last shot, and it seemed to have failed. Most of the agents working in the EOC had homes in the Bay Area. The admin desk had organized the evacuation of all their families. The building they were in was considered as safe as any. It had been retrofitted by the military to make it earthquake-resistant. But they could not flee. Like soldiers, like firefighters, like cops, they had to go where the danger was. It was their job. Outside on the parade ground, a fleet of helicopters stood ready with their rotors turning, waiting to take Judy and her colleagues into the earthquake zone. Priest went to the bathroom. While he was washing his hands, he heard Melanie scream. He ran to the office with wet hands. He found her staring at the TV. "What is it?" he said. Her face was white and her hand covered her mouth.
"Dusty," she said, pointing at the screen.
Priest saw Melanie's husband being interviewed. He had their son on his knee. A moment later, the picture changed, and a female anchor said, "That was Alex Day interviewing one of the world's leading seismologists, Professor Michael Quirkus, at the FBI's Emergency Operations Center in the Presidio."
"Dusty's in San Francisco,"
Melanie said hysterically.
"No, he's not," Priest said.
"Maybe he was when the interview was filmed. By now he's miles away."
"You don't know that."
"Of course I do. So do you. Michael's going to take care of his kid."
"I wish I could be sure,"
Melanie said in a shaky voice. "Make a cup of coffee," Priest said, just to give her something to do.
"Okay."
She took the pan from the hot plate and went to fill it with water in the restroom. Judy looked at the clock. It was 6:30. Her phone rang. The room fell silent. She snatched up the handset, dropped it, cursed, picked it up again, and held it to her ear.
"Yes?"
The switchboard operator said, "Melanie Quirkus asking for her husband."
"Thank God."
Judy pointed at Raja.
"Trace the call."
He was already speaking into his phone. Judy said to the operator,
"Put her on."
All the suits from the head shed gathered around Judy's chair. They stood silent, straining to hear.
"This could be the most important phone call of my life."
There was a click on the line. Judy tried to make her voice calm and said,
"Agent Maddox here. Where's Michael?"
Melanie sounded so frightened and lost that Judy felt a surge of compassion for her. She seemed no more than a foolish mother worried about her child.
"Get real, Judy. This woman is a killer."
Judy hardened her heart.
"Where are you, Melanie?" "Please," Melanie whispered, "just tell me where he's taken Dusty."
"Let's make a deal," Judy said. "I'll make sure Dusty's okay if you tell me where the seismic vibrator is."
"Can I speak to my husband?"
"Are you with Ricky Granger? I mean, Priest?"
"Yes."
"And you have the seismic vibrator wherever you are?"
"Yes."
"Then we've almost got you. Melanie, do you really want to kill all those people?"
"No, but we have to."
"You won't be able to take care of Dusty while you're in jail. You'll miss watching him grow up." Judy heard a sob at the other end of the line. "You'll only ever see him through a glass partition. By the time they let you out, he'll be a grown man who doesn't know you." Melanie was crying.
"Tell me where you are, Melanie."
In the big ballroom, the silence was total. No one moved. Melanie whispered something, but Judy could not hear it.
"Speak up."
At the other end of the line in the background, a man shouted, "Who the fuck are you calling?" Judy said, "Quickly, quickly, tell me where you are." The man roared, "Give me that goddamn phone!" Melanie said, "Perpetua..." Then she screamed. A moment later, the connection was broken. Roger said,
"She's somewhere on the bay shore, south of the city."
"That's not good enough," Judy cried.
"They can't be more precise." "Shit!"
Stuart Cleaver said, "Quiet, everybody. We'll play the tape back in a moment. First, Judy, did she give you any clues?"
"She said something at the end. It sounded like Perpetual. Carl, check for a street called Perpetual."
Roger said, "We should check for a company, too. They could be in the garage of an office building." "Do that." Cleaver pounded the table in frustration. What made her hang up?
I think Granger found her calling and took the phone away.
What do you want to do now?
I'd like to get in the air, Judy said. We can fly down the shoreline.
Michael can come with me and point out where fault lines run. Maybe we'll spot the seismic vibrator.
Do it, Cleaver said.
Priest stared at Melanie in fury as she cowered up against the grimy wash basin. She had tried to betray him. He would have shot her right there and then if he had had a gun. But the revolver he had taken from the guard at Los Alamos was in the seismic vibrator, under the driver's seat. He switched off Melanie's phone, dropped it into his shirt pocket, and tried to make himself calm. This was something Starr had taught him. As a young man, he had given way to his rages, knowing that they frightened others, because people were easier to deal with when they were scared. But Starr had taught him to breathe right and relax and think, which was better in the long run. Now he considered the damage Melanie had done. Had the FBI been able to trace her phone? Could they find out where a mobile was calling from? He had to assume they could. If so, they would soon be cruising the neighborhood, looking for a seismic vibrator. He had run out of time. The seismic window opened at 6:40. He looked at his watch. It was 6:35. To hell with his 7 o'clock deadline. He had to trigger the earthquake right now. He ran out of the restroom. The seismic vibrator stood in the middle of the empty warehouse, facing the high entrance doors. He jumped up into the driver's cabin and started the engine. It took a minute or two for pressure to build up in the vibrating mechanism. He watched the gauges impatiently. Come on, come on. At last the readings went green. The passenger door of the truck opened and Melanie climbed in.
Don't do it, she yelled. I don't know where Dusty is.
Priest reached out to the lever that lowered the plate of the vibrator to the ground. Melanie knocked his hand aside.
Please, don't!
Priest hit her backhanded across the face. She screamed, and blood came from her lip.
Stay out of the damn way, he yelled.
He pulled the lever, and the plate descended. Melanie reached across and threw the lever back to its start position. Priest saw red. He hit her again. She cried out and covered her face with her hands, but she did not flee. Priest returned the lever to the down position.
Please, she said, don't!
What am I going to do with this stupid bitch? He remembered the gun. It was under his seat. He reached down and snatched it up. It was too big, a clumsy weapon in such a small space. He pointed it at Melanie. Get out of the truck, he said. To his surprise, she reached across him again, pressing her body against the barrel of the gun and threw the lever. He pulled the trigger. The bang was deafening in the little cabin of the truck. For a split second, a small part of his mind felt a shock of grief that he had ruined her beautiful body, but he dismissed the feeling. She was thrown back across the cab. The door was still open, and she fell out and tumbled down, hitting the floor of the warehouse with a sickening thud. Priest did not stop to see if she was dead. For the third time, he pulled the lever. Slowly, the plate descended to the ground. When it made contact, Priest started the machine. The helicopter was a four-seater. Judy sat next to the pilot, Michael behind. As they flew south along the shore of the San Francisco Bay, Judy heard in her headphones the voice of one of Michael's student assistants, calling from the command post.
Michael, this is Paula. It started up. A seismic vibrator.
Judy went cold with fear. I thought I had more time. She checked her watch. It was 6:45. Granger's deadline was still 15 minutes away. Melanie's phone call must have made him start early. Michael was saying, any tremors on the seismograph?
No, just the seismic vibrator so far.
No earthquake yet, thank God. Judy shouted into her microphone,
give us the location, quickly.
Wait a minute, the coordinates are coming up now.
Judy grabbed a map.
Hurry, hurry.
A long moment later, Paula read the numbers on her screen. Judy found the location on her map. She said to the pilot, "Due south 2 miles, then about 500 yards inland." Her stomach lurched as the chopper dived and picked up speed. They were flying over the old waterfront neighborhood, full of derelict factories and car dumps. It would have been quiet on a normal Sunday. Today it was empty. Judy scanned the horizon, looking for a truck that could be the seismic vibrator. To the south, she saw 2 police patrol cars speeding toward the same location. Looking west, she spotted the FBI SWAT wagon approaching. Back at the Presidio, the other helicopters would be lifting off, full of armed agents. Soon, half the law enforcement vehicles in Northern California would be heading for the map coordinates Paula had given out. Michael said into his microphone, "Paula, what's happening on your screens?"
"Nothing. The vibrator is operating, but it's not having any effect."
"Thank God," Judy said.
Michael said, "If he follows his previous pattern, he'll move the truck 1/4 mile and try again." The pilot said, "This is it. We've arrived at the coordinates."
The helicopter began to circle.
Judy and Michael stared out, searching frantically for the seismic vibrator. On the ground, nothing moved. Priest cursed. The vibrating machinery was operating, but there was no earthquake. This had happened before, both times. Melanie had said she did not really understand why it worked in some locations, but not others. It probably had something to do with different kinds of subsoil. Both times, the vibrator had triggered an earthquake on the third try. But today, Priest really needed to be lucky the first time. He was not. Boiling with frustration, he turned off the mechanism and raised the plate. He had to move the truck. He jumped out. Stepping over Melanie, who was crumpled up against the wall, bleeding onto the concrete floor, he ran to the entrance. There was a pair of old-fashioned high doors that folded back to admit big vehicles. Inset into one panel was a small people-sized door. Priest threw it open. Over the entrance to a small warehouse, Judy saw a sign that read Perpetua Diaries. She had thought Melanie was saying Perpetual.
"That's the place," she yelled. "Go down."
The helicopter descended rapidly, avoiding a power line that ran from pole to pole along the side of the road, and touched down in the middle of the deserted street. As soon as she felt the bump of contact with the ground, Judy opened the door. Priest looked out. A helicopter had landed in the road. As he watched, someone jumped out. It was a woman with a wound dressing on her face. He recognized Judy Maddox. He screamed a curse that was lost in the noise of the chopper. There was no time to open the big doors. He dashed back to the truck, got in, and rammed the shift into reverse. He backed as far as he could into the warehouse, stopping when the rear bumper hit the wall. Then he engaged first gear. He revved the engine high, then let out the clutch with a jerk. The truck lurched forward. Priest pressed the pedal to the floor. Engine screaming, the big truck gathered speed the length of the warehouse, then crashed into the old wooden door. Judy Maddox was standing right in front of the door, gun in hand. Shock and fear showed on her face as the truck burst through the door. Priest grinned savagely as he bore down on her. She dived sideways, and the truck missed her by an inch. The helicopter was in the middle of the road. A man was getting out. Priest recognized Michael Quirkus. He steered toward the helicopter, changed up a gear, and accelerated. Judy rolled over, aimed at the driver's door, and squeezed off 2 shots. She thought she might have hit something, but she failed to stop the truck. The chopper lifted quickly. Michael ran to the side of the road. Judy guessed that Granger was hoping to clip the helicopter's undercarriage, as he had in Felicitas, but this time the pilot was too quick for him and lifted high as the truck charged the space where the aircraft had been. But in his haste, the pilot forgot the roadside power lines. There were 5 or 6 cables stretched between tall poles. The rotor blade caught in the lines, slicing through some. The helicopter's engine faltered. One of the poles tilted under the strain and fell. The rotor blade began to spin freely again, but the chopper had lost lift, and it fell to the ground with a mighty crash. Priest had one hope left. If he could drive a quarter of a mile, then get the plate down and the vibrator operating, he might yet trigger an earthquake before the FBI could get to him. And in the chaos of an earthquake, he might escape as he had before. He wrenched the wheel around and headed down the road. Judy fired again as the truck swung away from the downed helicopter. She was hoping to hit either Granger or some essential part of the engine, but she was unlucky. The truck lumbered down the potholed road. She looked at the crashed helicopter. The pilot was not moving. She looked back to the seismic vibrator as it gradually gathered speed.
I wish I had a rifle.
Michael ran up to her.
Are you okay?
Yes, she said. She made a decision. You see if you can help the pilot. I'll go after Granger. He hesitated, then said, okay.
Judy holstered her pistol and ran after the truck.
It was a sluggish vehicle, taking long moments to accelerate. At first, she closed the distance rapidly. Then Granger changed gear, and the truck picked up speed. Judy ran as fast as she could, heart pounding, chest aching. The tail of the truck carried a huge spare wheel. She was still gaining on it, but not so rapidly. Just when she thought she would never catch it, Granger shifted gears again, and in the momentary slowdown, Judy put on a burst of speed and leaped for the tailgate. She got one foot on the bumper and grabbed the spare wheel. For a frightening moment, she thought she would slip and fall, and she looked down to see the road speeding beneath her. But she managed to hold on. She clambered onto the flatbed among the tanks and valves of the machinery. She staggered to keep her balance, almost fell, and righted herself. She did not know whether Granger had seen her. He could not operate the vibrator while the truck was in motion, so she remained where she was, heart thumping, waiting for him to stop. But he had seen her. She heard glass shatter and saw the barrel of a gun poke through the rear window of the driver's cabin. She ducked instinctively. The next moment she heard a slug ricochet off a tank beside her. She leaned to the left so that she was directly behind Granger and crouched low, heart in her mouth. She heard another shot and cringed, but it missed her. Then he seemed to give up. But he had not. The truck braked fiercely. Judy was thrown forward, banging her head painfully against a pipe. Then Granger swerved violently to the right. Judy swung sideways and thought for a terrifying moment that she would be hurled to her death on the hard surface of the road, but she managed to hang on. She saw that Granger was heading suicidally straight for the brick front of a disused factory. She clung to a tank. At the last moment, he braked hard and swerved, but he was a fraction of a second too late. He averted a head-on smash, but the offside fender plowed into the brickwork with a crash of crumpling metal and breaking glass. Judy felt an agonizing pain in her ribs as she was crushed against the tank she was holding. Then she was thrown into the air. For a dizzy moment, she was totally disoriented. Then she hit the ground, landing on her left side. All the breath was knocked out of her body so that she could not even yell with pain. Her head banged against the road, her left arm went numb, and panic filled her mind. Her head cleared a second or two later. She hurt, but she could move. Her bulletproof jacket had helped to protect her. Her black corduroys were ripped and one knee was bleeding, but not badly. Her nose was bleeding, too. She had reopened the wound Granger had given her yesterday. She had fallen near the rear corner of the truck, close to its enormous double wheels. If Granger reversed a yard, he would kill her. She rolled sideways, staying behind the truck but getting away from its giant tires. The effort sent sharp pain through her ribs, and she cursed. The truck did not reverse. Granger was not trying to run her over. Perhaps he had not seen where she had fallen. She looked up and down the street. She could see Michael struggling to get the pilot out of the crashed helicopter, 400 yards away. In the other direction, there was no sign of the SWAT wagon or the police cars she had spotted from the air, or of the other FBI helicopters. They were probably seconds away, but she did not have seconds to spare. She got to her knees and drew her weapon. She expected Granger to jump out of the cabin and shoot at her, but he did not. She struggled painfully to her feet. If she approached on the driver's side of the truck, he would surely see her in his side-view mirror. She went to the other side and risked a peek around the rear corner. There was a big mirror on this side, too. She dropped to her knees, lay flat on her belly, and crawled under the truck. She wriggled forward until she was almost beneath the driver's cab. She heard a new noise above her and wondered what it was. Glancing up, she saw a huge steel plate above her. It was being lowered onto her. Frantically, she rolled sideways. Her foot caught on one of the rear wheels. For a few horrendous seconds, she struggled to free herself as the massive plate moved inexorably down. It would crush her leg like a plastic toy. At the last moment, she pulled her foot out of her shoe and rolled clear. She was out in the open. Granger would see her at any second. If he leaned out of the passenger door now, gun in hand, he could shoot her easily. There was a blast like a bomb in her ears, and the ground beneath her shook violently. He had started the vibrator. She had to stop it. She thought momentarily of Beau's house. In her mind, she saw it crumble and fall, then the whole street collapse. Pressing her left hand to her side to ease the pain, she forced herself to her feet. Two paces took her to the near side door. She needed to open it with her right hand, so she shifted the gun to her left, she could shoot with either, and pointed it up to the sky. Now. She jumped onto the step, grabbed the door handle, and flung it open. She came face to face with Richard Granger. He looked as scared as she felt. She pointed the gun at him with her left hand. "Turn it off!" she screamed. "Turn it off!" "Okay," he said, and he grinned and reached beneath his seat. The grin alerted her. She knew he was not going to turn off the vibrator. She got ready to shoot him. She had never shot anyone before. His hand came up holding a revolver like something out of the Wild West. As the long barrel swung toward her, she aimed her pistol at his head and squeezed the trigger. The bullet hit him in the face, beside the nose. He shot her a split second later. The flash and noise of the double gunshot was terrific. She felt a burning pain across her right temple. Years of training came into play. She had been taught always to fire twice, and her muscles remembered. Automatically, she pulled the trigger again. This time, she hit his shoulder. Blood spurted immediately. He spun sideways and fell back against the door, dropping the gun from limp fingers. "Oh, Jesus, is that what it's like when you kill someone?" Judy felt her own blood course down her right cheek. She fought a wave of faintness and nausea. She held the gun pointed at Granger. The machine was still vibrating. She stared at the massive switches and dials. She had just shot the one person who knew how to turn the thing off. Panic swept over her. She fought it down. "There must be a key." There was. She reached over the inert body of Ricky Granger and turned it. Suddenly, there was quiet. She glanced along the street. Outside the Perpetua Diaries warehouse, the helicopter was on fire. Michael. She opened the door of the truck, fighting to stay conscious. She knew there was something she ought to do, something important, before she went to help Michael, but she could not think what it was. She gave up trying to remember and climbed out of the truck. A distant police siren came closer, and she saw a patrol car approaching. She waved it down. "FBI," she said weakly. "Take me to that chopper." She opened the door and fell into the car. The cop drove the 400 yards to the warehouse and pulled up a safe distance from the burning aircraft. Judy got out. She could not see anyone inside the helicopter. "Michael," she yelled, "where are you?"
"Over here."
He was behind the busted doors of the warehouse, bending over the pilot. Judy ran to him. "This guy needs help," Michael said. He looked at her face.
"Jesus, so do you."
"I'm all right," she said. "Help is on the way." She pulled out her cell phone and called the command post. She got Roger. He said,
"Judy, what's happening?"
"You tell me, for Christ's sake."
"The vibrator stopped."
"I know, I stopped it. Any tremors?"
"No, nothing at all."
Judy slumped with relief. She had stopped the machine in time. There would be no earthquake. She leaned against the wall. She felt faint. She struggled to stay upright. She felt no triumph, no sense of victory. Perhaps that would come later with Raja and Carl and the others in Everton's bar. For now, she was drained empty. Another patrol car pulled up, and an officer got out. "Lieutenant Forbes," he said. "What the hell went on here? Where's the perpetrator?" Judy pointed along the street to the seismic vibrator.
"He's in the front of that truck," she said. "Dead."
"We'll take a look." The lieutenant got back in his car and tore off down the street. Michael had disappeared. Looking for him, Judy stepped inside the warehouse. She saw him sitting on the concrete floor in a pool of blood. But he was unhurt. In his arms he held Melanie. Her face was even paler than usual, and her skimpy T-shirt was soaked with blood from a grisly wound in her chest. Michael's face was contorted with grief. Judy went to him and knelt beside him. She felt for a pulse in Melanie's neck. There was none.
"I'm sorry, Michael," she said. "I'm so sorry."
He swallowed. "Poor Dusty," he said. Judy touched his face.
"It will be all right," she said.
A few moments later, Lieutenant Forbes reappeared.
"Pardon me, ma'am," he said politely. "Did you say there was a dead man in that truck?"
"Yes," she said. "I shot him."
"Well," the cop said, "he ain't there now."
Chapter 22. The last chapter. Starr was jailed for 10 years. At first, prison was torture. The regimented existence was hell for someone whose whole life had been about freedom. Then a pretty wardress called Jane fell in love with her and brought her makeup and books and marijuana, and things began to look up. Flower was placed with foster parents, a Methodist minister and his wife. They were kind-hearted people who could not begin to understand where Flower was coming from. She missed her parents, did poorly at school, and got in more trouble with the police. Then, a couple of years later, she found her grandma. Veronica Nightingale had been 13 when she gave birth to Priest, so she was only in her mid-60s when Flower found her. She was running a store in Los Angeles selling sex toys, lingerie, and porno videos. She had an apartment in Beverly Hills and drove a red sports car, and she told Flower stories about her daddy when he was a little boy. Flower ran away from the minister and his wife and moved in with her grandma. Oak Tree disappeared. Judy knew there had been a fourth person in the CUDA at Felicitas, and she had been able to piece together his role in the affair. She even got a full set of fingerprints from his woodwork shop at the commune. But no one knew where he had gone. However, his prints showed up a couple of years later on a stolen car that had been used in an armed robbery in Seattle. The police did not suspect him because he had a solid alibi, but Judy was automatically notified. When she reviewed the file with the U.S. attorney, her old friend Don Riley, now married to an insurance saleswoman, they realized they had only a weak case against Oak Tree for his part in the Hammer of Eden, and they decided to let him be. Milton Lestrange died of cancer. Brian Kincaid retired. Marvin Hayes resigned and became security director for a supermarket chain. Michael Quirkus became moderately famous. Because he was nice-looking and good at explaining seismology, TV shows always called him first when they wanted a quote about earthquakes. His business prospered. Judy was promoted to supervisor. She moved in with Michael and Dusty. When Michael's business started to make real money, they bought a house together and decided to have a baby. A month later, she was pregnant, so they got married. Beau cried at the wedding. Judy figured out how Granger had got away. The wound to his face was nasty but not serious. The bullet to his shoulder had nicked a vein, and the sudden loss of blood caused him to lose consciousness. Judy should have checked his pulse before going to help Michael, but she was weakened by her injuries and confused because of loss of blood, and she failed to follow routine. Granger's slumped position caused his blood pressure to rise again, and he came around a few seconds after she left. He crawled around the corner to 3rd Street, where he was lucky enough to find a car waiting at a stoplight. He got in, pointed his gun at the driver, and demanded to be taken to the city. En route, he used Melanie's mobile to call Paul Beale, the wine bottler who was a criminal associate of Granger's from the old days. Beale had given him the address of a crooked doctor. Granger made the driver drop him at a corner in a grungy neighborhood. The traumatized citizen drove home, called the local police precinct house, got a busy signal, and did not get around to reporting the incident until the next day. The doctor, a disbarred surgeon who was a morphine addict, patched Granger up. Granger stayed at the doctor's apartment overnight, then left. Judy never found out where he went after that. The water is rising fast. It has flooded all the little wooden houses. Behind the closed doors, the homemade beds and chairs are floating. The cookhouse and the temple are also awash. He has waited weeks for the water to reach the vineyard. Now it has, and the precious plants are drowning. He had been hoping he might find spirit here, but his dog is long gone. He has drunk a bottle of his favorite wine. It is difficult for him to drink or eat because of the wound to his face, which has been sewn up badly by a doctor who was stoned. But he has succeeded in pouring enough down his throat to make himself drunk. He throws the bottle away and takes from his pocket a big joint of marijuana laced with enough heroin to knock him out. He lights it, takes a puff, and walks down the hill. When the water is up to his thighs, he sits down. He takes a last look around his valley. It is almost unrecognizable. There is no tumbling stream. Only the roofs of the buildings are visible, and they look like upturned shipwrecks floating on the surface of a lagoon. The vines he planted 25 years ago are now submerged. It is not a valley anymore. It has become a lake, and everything that was here has been killed. He takes a long pull on the joint between his fingers. He draws the deadly smoke deep into his lungs. He feels the rush of pleasure as the drug enters his bloodstream and the chemicals flood his brain. Little Ricky, happy at last, he thinks. He rolls over and falls in the water. He lies face down, helpless, stoned out of his mind. Slowly, his consciousness fades, like a distant lamp becoming dimmer, until at last the light goes out. Acknowledgements. I am grateful to the following people for help with this book. Governor Pete Wilson of California, Jonathan R. Wilcox, Deputy Director, Office of Public Affairs, Office of Governor Pete Wilson, Andrew Pote, Chief Deputy Director, Department of Transportation. Mark D. Zoback, Professor of Geophysics, Chairman, Department of Geophysics, Stanford University. In the San Francisco Field Office of the FBI, Special Agent George E. Groats, Director of Press Relations and Public Affairs, who opened many doors. Special Agent Candace DeLong, Profiling Coordinator, who generously spent much time helping me with the details of an agent's life and work. Bob Walsh, Special Agent in Charge. George Vinson, Assistant Special Agent in Charge. Charles W. Matthews III, Associate Special Agent in Charge. Supervising Special Agent John Gray, Crisis Management Coordinator. Supervising Special Agent Don Whaley, Chief Division Counsel. Supervising Special Agent Larry Long, Tech Squad. Special Agent Tony Maxwell, Evidence Response Team Coordinator. Dominic Gitzi, Administrative Officer. In the Sacramento Field Office of the FBI, Special Agent Carol McCotzi, Special Agent Mike Ernst, Pearl Greaves, Computer Specialist, Information Resources Division, FBI Headquarters, Sierra County Sheriff Lee Adams, Lucian G. Canton, Director, Mayor's Office of Emergency Services, San Francisco. James F. Davis, Ph.D., California State Geologist. Ms. Sherry Reeser, Information Officer, Department of Conservation. Charles Yanez, Manager, South Texas Western Geophysical. Janet Loveday, Western Geophysical. Rhonda G. Boone, Manager, Corporate Communications, Western Atlas International. Donnie McClendon, Western Geophysical, Freer, Texas. Mr. Jesse Rosas, Bulldozer Driver. Seth Rosing DeLong. Dr. Keith J. Rosing, Director of Emergency Services, Irvine Medical Center. Brian Butterworth, Professor of Cognitive Neuropsychology, University College London. Most of the above were found for me by Dan Sterer of Research for Writers, New York City. As always, my outlines and drafts were read and criticized constructively by my agent, Dal Zuckerman, my editors, Ann Patty in New York and Suzanne Babineau in London, and numerous friends and relatives, including George Brennan, Barbara Follett, Angus James, Jan Turner, and Kim Turner. This concludes the reading of The Hammer of Eden by Ken Follett. This book was read by Alexander Adams.